that are going around almost 4,000, almost up to 8,000. And by the time it slows down and gets into the atmosphere, you know, it tends to really get hot because of the high speed. It's coming in at, in this case, they said 2 kilometers an hour compared to the ISS mission when it was 1 kilometer an hour. So it's a big difference in speed. And because speed creates additional heating, so he had to fire 3 engines, and the engines itself are acting as a bit of a shield as he's coming down into the atmosphere. And then it's a direct shot in. He doesn't have the boost back capability on this mission because he's really out of fuel. The boost back is he's able to bring it back to the barge only a couple hundred miles offshore. This time he was roughly, they said, around 400 miles out to sea. So it does a parabolic arc all the way down to the barge without doing a boost back. So he's virtually out of fuel, but he succeeded. And it's pretty interesting. His next flight would be for DIACOM. That's coming up at the end of the month. And it's going to be another similar flight like this one. But he's getting good at this. That was breaking news, so let me continue on with a couple of the other things that I had regarding the International Space Station, this WS2M. They have batteries on board. We've talked about batteries on the ISS many times, but I figured out from the weight of the batteries, and I had found one report on one of the websites talking about the weight and how many batteries they have, and their total price, the total weight that they have is 20,000 pounds roughly worth of batteries. I know that they're distributed evenly on the trusses outside, right near where the solar panels are. So he's got these large, I guess, suitcase type of battery components. It's more than batteries. It's batteries and it's all kinds of DC to DC converters, and all kinds of heating elements to transfer the heat to the ammonia systems. But in any case, these have to be changed out. They've been up there for many years, and they're going to start this in probably October or November when another cargo ship from Japan goes up to the space station. This time they're bringing batteries up, and instead of the nickel hydrate batteries that they have up there, they're switching over to lithium ion, which of course we know is a lot better. So a lot lighter, and they say it's roughly 2-to-1 weight, and compared to the power that they put out. So, time marches on. They're putting all lithium ions up. This will probably take a couple of years to do. They're only doing the first set now. Let me drop it. These batteries are in line with these solar cells. There's 4 main sets of solar cells, and they're located on starboard 4, starboard 6, truss section, port 4, port 6, and where the solar panels come together. On the trusses, they have these big areas with these batteries, and suitcase-like size things are bolted down, and they have to unbolt them. And instead of doing it manually with people, astronauts will go out and do the changeover when the batteries come in on the Japanese cargo vessel. But to loosen all these bolts up and do all this work, Hatcher has been doing it from the ground using the Dextra robot. There's a Dextra robot attached to the outside of the space station that's been up there for probably 6, 7, 8 years. And they use this robot to loosen up all the bolts, and it's going to save quite a bit of EVA time, which of course is dangerous. They try to cut that down to a minimum. Instead of, you know, 6 or 8 EVAs, they'll bring it down to around 2. So I want to bring that up. I know it's maintenance, but it's all part of the International Space Station system. Dick, I'll send it back to you. There's a lot more if you want to continue on different topics, but I think that's good for now. This is WS2M.
That's really something, Paul. You said that 1 mile per hour. I missed that. At the end of the boost, when it's bringing something up, bringing cargo up to the International Space Station, and there's the first stage booster, which is the big, long one, with lots of fuel inside at the beginning of it and lots of rocket engines on the back of it. I presume what it does is to, at the end of that boost, the second stage takes over. The first stage now, I'm guessing, just glides into a parabolic curve, a trajectory, maybe does a little bit of a retro burn, comes back into the atmosphere, and the barge has its position out there at just the right point in space, in the ocean. So that all it's got to do is a little bit of a retro burn as it comes down. I think he's saying it doesn't use a parachute. So I think it comes down with a pure retro burn in order to come down by gravity and approach some very low velocity as it approaches the barge as the target. And if you were launching a spacecraft if you are using that same booster to launch a spacecraft to a geosynchronous orbit, again, the first stage would, I think, boost for almost the same length of time, almost the same altitude. Now the second stage and the third stage would take over in order to really get you up to the geosynchronous orbit, 22,300 miles away. So whether the booster is going, is the boosting a cargo ship to the space station, or is boosting a multi-stage plane to geosynchronous orbit, I think the boost is going to go to roughly the same altitude and roughly the same speed. It's got a certain amount of energy capability of its rocket motors to lift a certain number of pounds to a certain altitude. And I think that becomes somewhat similar. I may have this backwards, Paul, so correct me on this. WS2N, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Yeah, I think that would hold true if they weren't bringing the back. They need almost 25% of the first stage. That's what kind of fuel they need to bring it back to the barge. But naturally, they use a lot more of it when they're trying to go to geosynchronous orbit. So there's a lot less fuel left in the tank. So that's why they don't have that margin. But yeah, you're right about the... it's normally 1 kilometer per hour when it hits... 1 kilometer per second when it hits the atmosphere. That's what they did for the low orbit NASA Dragon mission. You know, 250 miles up, but when they're coming back from pushing a satellite to geosynchronous orbit, they're using a lot more of that fuel to increase the speed before the second stage separates. And now when that first stage starts re-entering the atmosphere, it's coming back twice the speed, roughly 2 kilometers per hour. You know, so I converted, at least per minute, correction, I'll get it right per second. So per hour-wise, if you think of it as miles per hour, I think it's easier to think of it that way. It's compared to 2,250 miles per hour. It's now coming back to 4,500 miles per hour. So it's a big difference when you hit the atmosphere. And I didn't get that from the website. When I see these things live, they have engineers talking from SpaceX, actually doing the reporting on their website. And
Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Oh, I know that's an accurate number. And they said it a couple of times. And it also described the orbit, what you were trying to say before about getting into that geosynchronous orbit. You know, it's really a two-stage rocket. That's what Falcon 9 is. Drop it. Falcon 9 has nine engines, nine Merlin 1D engines. 1D meaning that there was an A and a C, and they dropped a B, but there was an A and a C and a D, and they got more advanced as time went on. But they have nine engines, one in the center, and then eight surrounding it like a big circle. And then as that first stage separates, they have another Merlin 1D engine on the second stage, and that has the capability of operating in a vacuum. It also has a longer cone, like the engineers they were talking about that on the website before the flight, with the longer cone coming off of it. Because it's longer, it's able to do more work, and actually, it's more productive than a shorter one. But the reason they don't have longer ones on the nine on the first stage is because when you get up to a certain speed, it's still within the atmosphere. It counteracts what you're going to gain out of it. So when they've improved on the Falcon 9 over years. The original ones actually had a little shorter cone, and now they've lengthened it, and then in lengthening it, they had to change the way it separates from the booster. But to make a long story short, their goal is to get the customer, in this case it was the Japan telecommunication satellite, into what they call geosynchronous transfer orbit.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
You know, they separate from that second stage. Let me drop it. Then it's up to the onboard rocket that is supplied by the customer. So the JC SAT-14 has its own rocket, which then puts itself into, from that high point that SpaceX got them up to 23,000 miles an hour. From that point, it over time it'll change to, a circular orbit. So that's the whole story on that. Now, the first stage, when it comes through the atmosphere, yes, there's no parachutes. It's propulsive all the way down. You have to understand that the easy way of doing it, which they did for the first barge landing, and also for the one going back to land that they did in December, landed at Cape Canaveral on landing zone one that SpaceX has already taken over. It used to be Launch Complex number 13. They have those two were boost back missions. They have plenty of margin, a lot of fuel left over. Drop it. So they had a boost back system. So what they separate from the second stage, and near the front of the first stage, they have small nitrogen rockets that come on, and they could roll the full first stage. They can push it in the yaw. And also, they have a backward-facing jets on this thing as well, facing the same direction as the big Falcon 9 rockets. And the reason for that is ullage. They're ullage type of rockets, which if they didn't have them, they wouldn't be able to get the fuel. Just kind of really, you have a rocket that just separated from the second stage. It's in zero G at the time. So you need to get the fuel to the back of the engine. So these small jets come on, and that accomplishes that. And then you're at the front of it, and then the engines are able to ignite on the, you know, for the boost back. They'll have the engines facing in the direction that they were going. And they'll come on for a period of time. And the amount of engines that come on are three. And then as it slows down, again, the nitrogen engines turn it around a little bit, and they face it in the tail first bow direction. On, you know, when they're entering the atmosphere, that'll slow it down a lot more. And then when they get near the autonomous spaceport drone ship, right near the end, that center engine will come on, or in the case when they were going back to Cape Canaveral on land, again, the center engine will come on, and that'll control the final landing. Before they do that, by the way, they have these spins near the top, and that aerodynamically brings them to the location that they want to land at. So, now, the difference between these two flights and the one that just happened on Wednesday is they've eliminated the boost back burn. They don't have enough fuel. They've already pushed the rocket to 4,000 miles per hour, and they're running out of fuel. So it separates, the little thrust is, the nitrogen thrust is turning the vehicle pretty much facing forward, but it's still on a parabolic crash course for the ocean. It's thrust into the atmosphere. Three engines come on to slow it down, and then when it starts dropping straight down, getting somewhere near the barge, instead of one engine coming on, it's still moving pretty fast. This time, three engines again come on. So that's the difference. And then right at the last, maybe 8 seconds or so, those two outer engines shut down, and only the center engine comes on. And that center engine, right after that comes on, these 60-foot legs pop open on the first stage, and then that will guide it in. That last engine will guide it in until it lands, hopefully. That's important. They need to get this high velocity flight done, because maybe half their flights, maybe more, are going to be geosynchronous type of flights. Over half their customers are, I'd say about two-thirds of the customers have nothing to do with NASA. And they've got to be able to do this to make it economical. Elon Musk believes that, it's very important to bring these rockets back to make space flight economical. So in the future, you're going to have not only a lot of geosynchronous flights, but you're going to have Falcon heavy flights go up. Let me drop it. This is WS2N, and we have the first Falcon Heavy flight coming in November, probably November, if it's not delayed, from Florida. Originally, about 3 years ago, when he wanted to do it, it was supposed to be launched from Vandenberg Air Force Base, but that's been changed to Florida. It's a demonstration flight. NASA's not paying for it. SpaceX, it's on their dime, and they'll be launching the Falcon Heavy, which is essentially three Falcon 9 boosters with a standard second stage mounted to the center stack. So to do it right, he needs to bring all, you know, all the time. He might not do it the first time, you know, first try, but he'll probably try it. The goal is to bring all three boosters back. And if he's doing that, the center one will probably definitely wind up on a barge, and the other two he'll probably try to bring back to land, or maybe back to a couple of barges. I don't know, that remains to be seen. That's going to be fun. See what happens in December. It should be November. I think it's scheduled for November. Back to you, the K2RIWWS2N.
I got a theory. I got a series of questions, Paul. If I understand you correctly, when you're boosting a craft to the International Space Station and it comes back into the atmosphere at something like 2,200 miles an hour, when you're boosting something to a geosynchronous orbit, you're boosting it to a higher altitude. Stand by a second. Yeah, I think I pressed the wrong button here. You're boosting it to a higher altitude, and it then comes back to the atmosphere at closer to 4,000 miles an hour. Hitting the atmosphere at 4,000 miles an hour is going to give you, I think, a significant amount of atmospheric heating. That's question number one. I wonder if they start doing some reverse boosting at that point to slow things down. And during the whole drop back down toward the barge, it would be nice to drop an elliptical trajectory and only turn on the rockets at the end, where you're going to get the most efficient. If you could take a movie of it blasting off from the ground, assuming it had no payload on top, just the booster itself, blasting off from the ground, getting up to a altitude of where the International Space Station is, and then you allow it to trajectory come back down. If the trajectory on the way down, position and velocity, was identical to that movie going up, and you just play the movie backwards, that would be the most efficient. When you read the book Thinking Physics by Louis Epstein, a beautiful paperback for around $35, very well done book, he shows you dropping a ball from the second floor of a building, and you take a movie of the ball dropping toward the ground and accelerating. Let me drop. And you know, during that whole drop, assuming there was no wind resistance, the ball would experience 1G of continuous acceleration. And you've made a movie of the ball dropping toward the ground. Now you play the movie backwards. What's the acceleration? And which direction? The thing that's amazing is that the acceleration is still in the downward direction, because now the movie playing backwards, the ball is going up, but it's slowing down as it approaches the window where it was dropped. And the ball is still experiencing exactly 1G of downward acceleration in both cases, whether the movie is played forward or backwards. Well, if you take a picture of the spacecraft, of the booster blasting off from Canaveral and then coming back, if the trajectory on the way back was the identical movie as on the way up, but you just play the movie backwards, that would be the most efficient. So they're entering the atmosphere at 4,000 miles an hour in the worst case situation. You'd like to have some kind of wings coming out to make sure that it drops down to the ground always in the vertical position with the rocket down, if you know what I mean. If it drops in any other direction, then you got to do some kind of orientation before you do the blasting. So what do they do to keep it oriented correctly? How soon do they turn on the rockets? Are you first hitting the atmosphere at 4,000 miles an hour, which I'm a little bit worried, tail first, 4,000 miles an hour, could create a significant amount of heating of the back end of those rocket engines. So maybe I'm a little naive in all this, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
I've seen a couple of news conferences, and Elon Musk was, of course, at a couple of them, and he talks about the boost back being done away with on this flight. And you know, he's got a background in physics, and he talked about heating. The heating is, I believe he said it was cubed or something. I can't remember the exact words, but yeah, tremendous heating compared to, you know, 2,000 miles an hour. It's, you come back at 4,000 miles an hour, you're going to have a lot of heating. And he worries that his booster might not survive that. But, you know, he built it robust enough where he thinks it might, and sure enough it did. But part of the plan is, right before, just like what you said, right before you get into the dense part of the atmosphere, you ignite the engines, in this case, three of the engines, and the engines do two things. It slows the spacecraft down from 4,000 miles per hour, and also the engine exhaust coming off acts as a bit of a shield for the whole spacecraft itself, so it tends to protect it. So then he does have these flaps, these four fins that open up near the top of the booster, and it does work, like you said, aerodynamically controlling it to get to this little barge, really the size of a football field. But,
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Postage stamp. Now, you also remember, the first stage is at all the way up to 240 miles. It's probably up 200 kilometers when we drop this. I think I remember looking at the altitude. You know, they have the digital readout as you watch these things fly. And I think it was around 200, 206 kilometers in height. And they give it a speed, and, you know, when it separates from the second stage. But it's still essentially in a rarefied air. It's really in a vacuum. So what controls the final descent? Now, this one, I couldn't see the arc coming down. The last flight, it was daytime, and they had a helicopter flying near the landing zone, near the barge, and you could see that rocket came in not straight down. It was coming off from the side. Now, what controls that last little bit getting to the barge is the center engine. Actually, all mine engines have the capability of being gimbaled, but in this case, the center engine is only firing, and you can see that movement. You can see the flame is not exactly parallel to the booster. You can see that moving around, fighting to get to its bullseye. And the other ways they control it too is with the nitrogen jets on top. Once in a while, you'll be able to see those things go off, trying to force the top end up one way or the other. So that's pretty much it. Back to you, Dick.
Now, you've given me quite a bit of extra information on that one, Paul. It turns out that wind force is a function of wind speed squared. If a hurricane is hitting your house at 70 miles an hour, that creates a certain amount of force. You double that speed. If the hurricane is 140 miles an hour, you get four times as much force on your house. It's velocity squared. Okay? So once you know the way air behaves, the force of hitting the air, the force is a function of airspeed squared. Okay? Energy is force through distance. A joule is a certain unit of energy. A joule is a newton meter. In other words, if you're pushing a block of wood against a floor, and if the amount of resistance you feel, is one newton, which is a little bit less than a quarter of a pound. If there's a quarter of a pound of resistance pushing this block of wood across the floor, a great big block of wood, we'll say, and you push it 1 meter, 1 meter, meter and 1 newton of force is a total energy exertion of 1 joule. You put 1 joule of energy into the process. Well, so you can see how force times distance is energy. Energy is heat. So therefore, when a rocket is re-entering, let me drop it. When a projectile is re-entering the atmosphere, the speed squared tells you how much wind force you get. That force through distance tells you how much energy you've dissipated. So therefore, it is velocity cubed. Square for force, and another times for the energy. So velocity cubed is proportional to the amount of heating you get. Therefore, a 4,000 mile an hour entry versus a 2,000 mile an entry, it's a 2-to-1 ratio, you're going to get almost 8 times as much heating at 4,000 miles an hour versus 2,000 miles an hour. Now, you're telling me he blasts the rockets at that time and then acts as a shield. I'm a little bit curious about that because the exhaust of a rocket engine is hot. That's a hot shield. The air hitting him is also creating heat by this velocity cube phenomenon. Let me drop it. Now, maybe what's going on is that the exhaust of the rocket engine hitting the incoming air, and the air is aimed right straight into the engine because of the four fins on top, keeping the thing properly oriented. Maybe the blast of the rocket engine hitting the air blasts the air off to one side. It doesn't come straight back against the side of the rocket. You heat the shield of the rocket. Heat the side, the skin of the rocket. So maybe it blasted off to one side, and that's how it creates the shield. That's interesting. That's some great physics here. So, I think you're saying he does do some blasting when he first enters the atmosphere. I am guessing now if he's got enough altitude, he can let it drop freely once he's slowed down to the point where the heating is not excessive. He can let it drop freely in the vertical mode, so to speak, with the four fins on the top. And only when he starts getting near the barge does he then do the final deceleration to make it land on the barge at the nearly 0 miles an hour. And on the way down, I am guessing he is steering those four fins in order to aim for the barge. He's using the fins as a rudder and elevator, is a guess on my part. So does he steer the fins, or does he use some other kind of reaction control jets to do the steering on the way down? WS2N, Space Report, K2RIW. Go ahead, Paul.
Everything except for the beginning, you were saying that the fins are open at this 4,000 mile an hour speed. That's not true. They probably rip them off, I guess. But they don't open at that speed. But the engines do ignite. The three engines do ignite and slows them down to. You know, I haven't seen what speed they get down to, but it does slow them down. And then the fins do open, and they actuate, you know, they could move in all kinds of different directions. And that does control it all the way down to where they have to land. And then at the last few seconds, it seems like the engine does come on, the center engine. So the difference is, going up to low Earth orbit, there's three engine firing systems, time periods that they're going to come on. Low Earth orbit, after it separates, you have a boost back system trying to get it back as close to land as possible, maybe back to a barge. And then you have another, after it enters this atmosphere and it's coming pretty much straight down, the fins are open, you'll have another engine burning system come on to slow down its descent, and then as it gets ready to barge, only the center engine will come on to do that. So that's the system. And then when you don't have enough fuel and you're going for geosynchronous orbit, then it's a little different. There's only two ignitions of the rockets. Let me drop it. You you've eliminated the boost back system, so you're just going to really travel in a parabolic arc. You know, you'll reorient your booster, make sure you come in at tail first, and you'll have your three engines come on. So that's one time you're igniting it. And that's as we spoke before you hit the atmosphere, try to use it as a shield and slow it down. And then as it's getting near the barge, all three engines will come on this time, right near the barge. And then just as it's, you know, it looked like, I guess it's about 6 seconds before, I'm going to say, the outer two engines shut down and then the other one keeps running. And that brings you back to the center of the ship. And after it lands, they bring a crew, and you know, nobody's on board this ship, and it's floating a couple miles away. They bring a crew, and everything is safed off. You know, that's all automatic. But then the crew gets on, and they weld the legs, these big aluminum legs, down to the deck of the steel ship, and they don't, of course, weld the legs. They take these big shoes, these big, I'm going to call them big U-bolts, and channel iron, huge, and they put it around each leg, four legs, and weld it to the deck of the ship, and it comes back that way, standing up. Back to you there.
That's kind of amazing. I think I heard you say the four legs come out and they're 60 feet long. Boy, that strikes me as awfully big. Maybe it's the total length of the leg structure, top to bottom, where some of it is a zigzag structure connected to the frame of the booster, and then some other number of feet of leg sticks below the booster with some kind of a springy device, some kind of a shock absorber. Well, my guess is, you said the legs are 60 feet long. My next question is, how long is the whole booster? Maybe the booster is 60 feet up high. That's one question. And the other question is, when you first enter the atmosphere at 4,000 miles an hour from a high altitude boost, and now you turn on the engines not only to start braking you from the 4,000 miles an hour when you hit the atmosphere, but that braking action acts as a shield. Are there only three engines that come on at that time? You would think there would have to be four, three outer and one center. To make a shield all the way around, there'd have to be something like three outer engines, I think. Although maybe just two outer engines. One engine at 12 o'clock, one engine at 6 o'clock are the outer engines, and then the center engine. Maybe that gives you enough boosting deceleration at 4,000 miles an hour. Maybe that gives you enough shield. So, two questions there, Paul. How many engines, when you hit at 4,000 miles an hour, are on? And are those legs 60 feet long, the leg structures? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, three engines come on. Set of ones, and then, you know, which ones he actually puts on, you know. I guess determines, I have no idea. You know, when you turn a booster, do you put on number one and number four? Do you put on number two? And, you know, but I'm sure it's opposing one another. But, yeah, it's only the three engines. Center one and then two other ones. So it's probably, you know, 6 o'clock and 12 o'clock. But it might be 1 o'clock and 7 o'clock. I don't know. You know, and these things also control from its onboard electronics. You know, it's got a, you know, I mean, this booster's got a lot of smarts to it. It's all autonomous as it's coming in. Nobody's controlling anything. And the diameter is really what I'm talking about. You know, one end to the other is 60 feet. So, let's call it, you know, 20, I think it's 27 feet, you know, from the end of the, from the edge of the booster to the end of one leg. But, I don't know, they always say 6 of the leg to the other. That's the best way to put it. And remember, the diameter of the booster is 12 foot, so you got to eliminate that. But these are all mounted on the side of the booster, and they come out with a big nitrogen charge pressing these things out at the very end. There was another question I forgot back to you.
So when the four legs come down to the ground, the diagonal spacing between those 2 feet of the legs is 60 feet. The booster itself, I think it said, is 12 feet in diameter. That I can picture. One end of my ranch house to the other end is 60 feet. If the spacing between the feet of those legs is 60 feet, wow, that's a big distance. That's a very wide quadruped, if you know what I mean. Oh, amazing. Let's see now. That was one question. Oh, yeah. Related to all of this, after it has slowed down enough hitting the atmosphere at 4,000 miles an hour, and is now with the fins trying to aim itself, the fins pop out, and is trying to aim itself the best it can to the barge, does it do that with a global positioning satellite receiver? In other words, it knows the coordinates of the barge, the lat and long. And it knows by way of GPS where it is, the booster. And does it steer the fins accordingly in order to be on the right flight path, that parabolic arc over to the barge? Is that how it does that, Paul? That's an amazing autonomous system. This guy's pretty smart. S2N, K2RIW.
Also wanted to know the length of the booster, Dick.
You're right, that's the length of the booster. Go ahead, Paul.
I almost forgot to wait for the beeps. The length of the booster, John, is I think 152 feet, if I'm not mistaken. Just over 150 feet. The whole length of the whole stack for the Falcon 9 is 229 feet. So, you know, the second stage and whatever's on top, you know, if it's a Dragon or if it's, in this case, the JC SAT-14 satellite, it's encapsulated in these fairings, these two big fairings, which, by the way, cost about $1 million a piece. They don't want to lose them either. They plan on recovering them someday soon. So, okay, I answered the height of the booster. And the fins, it's controlled, GPS. I know it's definitely used. Whether they're sending a signal out from the barge or not, some kind of radar contact, I doubt it. I think it's all GPS, but I haven't heard that one way or the other. But, it's quite an accomplishment. This guy, every time he comes out and says something, he does it. He started with the Falcon 1, just one engine, and I think on the fourth try, he made it to orbit from Kwajalein Island, and then he kept making statements. He was going to build a Dragon, put it on top of a Falcon 9, and send it up to the space station. He did that. At that time, the early flights were, if you look at his engines, they were arranged like in a square form, three engines in line with one another. So he had, he had a 3x3 pattern. He changed all of that. He created this octo web. He calls it an octo web system. One engine in the middle, 8 on the outside. He's not going to be able to do that. It's going to cost him too much money. Yeah, he went and did that. He test flew a Dragon crew vehicle off of Launch Complex 40, sent it a couple of miles out to the water to prove that his escape system would work. Dragon from Cape Canaveral and prove that his safety system would work. Not only the safety system, he plans on using these things eventually for propulsive landing on land. His long-term goal is to, let's say, bring a crew up to the International Space Station, separate from the space station, and bring this Dragon back to land with no parachutes, you know, just a heat shield and propulsive landing all the way down. So will he do that? I don't know. Everything he says he's going to do, he seems to do it. He's been talking about the Falcon 9 Heavy, and now it's just called Falcon Heavy, or FH, being launched from Cape Canaveral. And sure enough, that will be going up in November. It'll be the biggest rocket in the world right now since the Saturn V. It'll have over 5 million pounds of thrust, and it'll be able to put twice the amount of cargo into low Earth orbit than what the shuttle could do. He says he's going to land a Dragon crew vehicle on Mars in 2018. Sounds ambitious. I'm not going to put anything past this guy. Back to you, Dick. WS2M.
Boy, I had a mental picture that was quite different, Paul. So that first stage booster, approximately 150 feet tall. Now I'm beginning to believe 60 foot of spacing in order to be a stable platform. I think it's a quadrupod, the landing feet. And each landing foot mechanism, I guess, is 60 foot long, which are telescopes out or in pantographs out from the side of the spacecraft, is my guess. Wild. And you think it's GPS, and maybe there is a beacon transmitter on the barge saying, here I am, come get me, because GPS could give you, I guess, numbers like 15 meters of error, which would allow you to miss the barge unless you're using precision GPS. Now you get down to meters. But you can guarantee the accuracy with no GPS interrupt. Every so often you get certain periods of time. Let me drop it. You get certain periods of time when the GPS satellite might not be directly near you, so to speak, to give you the most accurate navigating, depending on what period in their orbits is when you're demanding the service. So I'm guessing there might be a beacon transmitter on the barge. And once you got the system perfected to the point where it's not going to land 20 miles away from where you desire, I can see no advantage in landing on a barge out at sea versus landing on land, as long as the landing pad has got quite a bit of dead space around it. So if you miss the target, you're still not hitting people's houses. So I see once he's proven the reliability of this targeting landing system. Let me drop it. I can envision that he's going to be landing on land and skip all this barging jazz. Although, wait a minute now. After you've done the boosting, you've done the end of the boosting quite a number of miles downrange. Therefore, you want that barge the right number of miles a little bit further downrange in that parabolic orbit, parabolic arc of trajectory in order to the ballistic trajectory in order to bring it back down. It would take a whole lot of extra fuel to, let's assume that the end of the boosting takes place 500 miles downrange. If you had to not only come down from a high altitude, not only decelerate from a high velocity, but reverse your path 500 miles to come back to the launch pad, I can see how that would take a lot of extra fuel. So putting a barge out there is the right way to do it. Unless he had some other landing site downrange, you know, somebody's island. You may not have an island in the right place. 150-foot booster. Wow. I think you've told us earlier, Paul, that he is planning to not only bring back the first stage boosting, but the second stage. Isn't he eventually going to bring back the second stage booster also and land that on either the same barge or another barge downrange? WS2N, K2RIW, go ahead, Paul.
I remember him talking about that quite a few years ago. fact, he had a an animation come out. What are you plans on doing? I'm trying to remember. But the goal is to bring everything back. And he already brings that back, the cargo dragon. That comes back on parachute and lands in the Pacific Ocean. He picks that up. In fact, that's going to be happening May 11th of this month. The Dragon will disembark the ISS and do exactly that. He's succeeded now at bringing the first stage back three times. And he's already gotten clearance from the FAA now to land his first stage back on land. He's done it already back in December of last year, 2015. That's what he did at first. It was a nighttime flight, and he landed right on the money on landing zone one. He is taking over three launch complexes in Cape Kennedy. He's taking over Launch Complex 40. That's where these things can get launched from. Now he's taking over Launch Complex 13. He's now called with Landing Zone 1. He's got a big bullseye with SpaceX right in the middle. Let me drop it. That's where he successfully brought back the other booster. That was the one he sent 11 satellites up in space. That was the OG-2 mission, they call it. One satellite right after the other. He saw it live, separating from the second stage, and he successfully brought that booster back. So now he's got three. He planned the first one, the one that landed on land. He's going to put that fourth on complex where in California. That's where his mission control is, and that's where he builds all the initially builds all these dragons and rockets and things. And he wants to put that on display because that's the first time he ever brought one back. But the last one that he brought back is sitting in storage right now. He plans on relaunching that. Second stage. He's got long term plans, but he needs. That's going to be I'm going to guess maybe 5 years, maybe longer before that happens. Let me drop it. First stage never goes into orbit. It gets up, maybe 400 or 500 miles downrange and lands on a barge. If it's a low Earth orbit, he'll bring it back to to land at Cape Canaveral Landing Zone 1. And which he's done. And he'll be doing that again on the next flight. He's got another geosynchronous orbit for DIOCOM, but he's got a cargo mission coming up, CRS number 9. That's the one they're going to bring up Ida, the International Docking Adapter, bolted up to the space station. That flight, he'll be bringing the stage back to Cape Canaveral again. That's pretty cool. Right back to land. So he's never going to give up the barges because everything that goes to geosynchronous orbit or using the Falcon Heavy is going to require a barge or maybe more than one barge out at sea to catch these things as they come back. Now, the second stage he's going to need, because it's going to be in orbit, he'll need a heat shield on it. Let me drop it. He plans on putting this similar Piker, they call it a Piker, a heat shield, what he has on the bottom of Dragon now, eventually onto the second stage. So now you can imagine this thing up there for, say 24 hours or whatever. Time to bring it back, deorbit it, and it'll come through, have all kinds of electronics. electronics on board to guide it back, and he'll be able to bring it back and land it wherever he wants. Probably not on a barge. He'll probably have to use a parachute or something. I don't know what he'll do, but his goal is to eventually bring that second stage back. So everything comes back except the solar panels and what they call the trunk. I think that'll be the only thing that gets burnt up in the atmosphere after every mission. Back either.
When it comes to re-entering a spacecraft that's been in orbit 17,500 miles an hour, you're hitting the atmosphere at, what is that? It's probably Mach 25, really fast. In the case of a Gemini, Mercury, or Apollo spacecraft, which is essentially a cone-shaped object, and the most stable way that for it to enter is a blunt end first. So you got a center of mass, and you got a center of pressure of that heat shield when it's hitting the atmosphere. And you want the center of mass to be very close to the center of the pressure of that heat shield, so you get a stable flight path, so to speak. You don't want that thing turning around nose sharp end first and burn up the astronauts. You want that heat shield to stay forward. In the case of a 150-foot tall first stage booster, and I don't know, I'm going to make a guess, maybe the second stage booster is 60 feet tall. It's a 60-foot tall cylinder, something like 8 feet in diameter. That thing doesn't want to come in blunt end first, if you know what I mean. It doesn't want to come in rocket end first or nose end first. That thing wants to come in sideways. No matter where you put a heat shield on that thing, it's not going to come in the right way. How in the world do you put a heat shield on a booster coming in at Mach 25 and make sure that only the heat shield is hitting the air? Has he mentioned any of the specifics on that, Paul? That sounds like a very difficult problem. WS2N, K2IW.
No, the interview I saw, he said it would require a heat shield and a lot of electronics to get back. But it's still a long-term goal. But right now, it's off the table. So, how do we set that up? It's going to be tough. But my guess will be the heat shield be in the front. He'll have to come back, and then somehow, after it's going slow enough, maybe turn it around. I can't imagine this rocket coming on and landing again with legs and all, so probably have to have a parachute. I don't know. He might not know, and I'm sure he's got his engineers working on it. But right now, they're concerned with doing the first stage on a regular basis. He wants to make it where it becomes boring. He says, in the interview, I'm paraphrasing, but, when people say, oh, another landing, another one came back and landed on the barge, because he's looking forward to that day, and then he could say it's routine. So, we'll see. Now, he's got plans on relaunching all of these things, dozens of times before they get refurbished. So, his goal is to drive the price down. Without bringing the second stage down, down to, I think in the beginning he's already down to taking the price off around 30%. So instead of a $60 million launch, he's looking at probably $40 million where he's going to charge the customers. And overall, on a regular basis, he wants to bring it down to,
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Eventually get down to 1 to 100 price ratio. Back to you guys.